This is a Carlisle ValueCast, brought to you by the Carlisle Group. ValueCast brings you insights from our One Carlisle Network, providing analysis, data, and observations to help you navigate the global economy and top-of-mind issues in news. The Carlisle Group. Invest wisely. Create value.
Greetings and welcome to Carlisle ValueCast. I'm Chris Ullman, head of Carlisle's Global Communications. Today we have a panel of energy experts who discuss a range of timely issues related to the global energy markets and the investment climate. The panelists are Ken Hirsch, CEO of NGP Energy Capital Management, a Carlisle Energy partner; Bob Mancini, co-head of Carlisle's power investing business; Dave Albert, co-head of Carlisle's energy mezzanine team; and Marcel Van Puca, head of Carlisle's international energy platform. The panel is moderated by Steve Muffson, a Washington Post reporter who writes on energy and other business issues. This panel was recorded live at Carlisle's annual Washington, D.C. Investor Conference in September 2013.
But I thought I'd start on obviously the biggest news and what's happening in the energy business, which is the huge explosion in shale gas reserves here in the United States, and ask a couple of people on the panel how they see different opportunities coming in this space and how it's affecting their areas of investment. I mean, generally, I should just say, you know, what I write about at the Post now is so radically different from what I was writing just 5 years ago in energy. And so I want to, hopefully, we'll be able to capture some of that dynamism. But maybe you could talk a bit about what you see as opportunities as a result of this development.
Ken Hirsch.
Sure. Happy to. We built our entire industry around thinking that reserves were scarce. And now we're in a world where, on the natural gas side, natural gas reserves are effectively infinite. Our great-great-grandchildren will not have to worry about natural gas supply. So the mind shift in thinking about whether it be policy or whether we rate companies or the industry is structured, it was built around scarcity. Now it's built around what to do with all this gas. So where we sit now today in the natural gas business is we need to understand that reserves doesn't equal production. There's a lot of reserves in the ground, but getting them out is separate. But the premium is no longer on finding where the next oil and gas is. Now we don't need to explore. We know right where all the gas is. So it's become much more of a model about efficiency, about return on capital, about understanding the exact flows and where the markets are. And that's created an incredible opportunity set, but it's also created some really weird things happening internally in the lower 48.
Did you want to say something about what that kind of lending opportunities that creates for you?
Dave Albert.
Yeah, I mean, the lending opportunities have been very attractive, and it's precisely because of what Ken just highlighted. The business, you know, in many respects, a large part of it is becoming more of a manufacturing operation. And so as a result of that, it is about keeping costs low. This applies, obviously, you know, to oil as well as to natural gas. But keeping costs low is critical, and there are a lot of opportunities out there where folks are interested in drilling and harvesting hydrocarbons, and it's all about doing it at the lowest cost possible and in an efficient manner, and that's what we can finance.
So given that these things, that there is certainty about what's out there, what's your role versus, say, what a bank might do?
We come in and we basically provide capital to companies that are not able to access the capital markets or are not able to access the commercial bank market. So basically, we're providing an alternative source of capital that folks would otherwise have to go to common equity, usually, to source. And so we enable owners of oil and gas assets, owners of power plants, to essentially keep control of governance and yet get that extra capital that they may need to fill the gap because the banks are quite conservative or not lending in certain circumstances. And the companies with whom we're dealing tend to be small enough so that they're not able to access the capital markets. So we're filling that void.
Bob, maybe you could talk a bit about the power sector, because obviously one of the big stories has been the extent to which natural gas is replacing coal power plants as well as nuclear, something that in some ways is a little counterintuitive because you would think existing nuclear plants would have pretty low marginal costs. So what do you see happening and the impact in your area?
Bob Mancini.
Well, Steve, the power markets are changing dramatically as a result of the supply of gas in the market. A couple of things are happening. You referenced a conversion in the market towards gas power generation away from coal. Remember, there was a time not that long ago that 60% of the generation in this country was powered by coal because on a relative basis, coal was much cheaper. That's no longer the case.
Now we're down to, what, 30 or so, right?
It's projected that by 2020 it'll be below 25%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other misconception I think people have is that all of this gas is going to enable us to eliminate coal altogether. That is not entirely true, and it won't be for many, many years, because the infrastructure necessary to get the gas in places where, you know, the gas doesn't exist naturally is very expensive, and there are a number of hurdles to do that. So there will always be a place for coal in certain locations, but the real transformation in places where gas is readily accessible is that we will see more and more gas transmission. Now, the other interesting phenomena is that, coincidentally, we have environmental regulations that were, you know, adopted years ago to require the phasing out of certain coal production and even some of the less efficient gas production. And frankly, we're getting bailed out by the fact that gas is so cheap, because had it not been, it's not clear how expensive it would have been to replace those coal assets.
So one of the big debates here, of course, is about LNG export facilities. Do you see any opportunity there? Is this a big deal in the investing world, or is this just a big deal here in our political bubble?
Marcel Van Pucke.
To follow up on the unconventional gas in Europe, there are ample reserves in the UK and in France and in other countries in Holland. But there's a lot of resistance to develop it. People don't own the mineral rights like here. There's not enough space to develop it. And so there's a lot of opposition in France. François Hollande said, I'm not going to develop it and I'm going to phase down nuclear. Same in Germany after Fukushima started phasing out the nukes. So it's very interesting development to see now that instead of using those LNG regas facilities, the import facilities for LNG in Europe, which have been developed over the last 10 years, we are importing coal from the US. So the US is pushing it out, and actually German power plants are switching on.
Ken Hirsch.
One other point on, while we know where all the gas is in the United States and in Canada, the complexity is way up. It's a manufacturing component to it, but there's high variability between plays, and the cost of individual unit economics is an order of magnitude greater than it was 15 years ago. When we started NGP in the 80s, an expensive well was $750,000. Today, it's a $10 million well. You run a one-rig program, one well a month, that's 12 rigs. You got 10 rigs running, you have a billion-dollar CapEx budget. That's 120 wells, that's all. But the individual elements of it are really quite complicated and really could be treacherous. LNG export and the LNG part of the equation today is zero on about pushing a 70 BCF a day demand base. If the numbers that, you know, I believe ultimately will settle, maybe 2 to 4 export terminals running at about 50% capacity would be about 3 to 4 BCF a day of export, which is interesting. But on a 70 BCF a day market, it will be a supplier in the global sense seasonally when we don't need it.
Maybe this would be a good time to turn back to you, Marcel, because a lot of the discoveries overseas have been gas discoveries, and a lot of them in areas and countries that really haven't had too many resources before, such as Mozambique. So what is this world market in natural gas going to mean for these kinds of developments in Africa and elsewhere?
Marcel Van Pucke.
First of all, what you see is outside of the U.S., there is a real shortage of gas developing. We found a lot of gas offshore Mozambique, but there is nothing. Everything has to be developed. Ports, infrastructure, rigs, producing facilities. So these are enormous projects, which if you look at a recent history, for instance, in Australia, where we've also developed those kind of resources, it tends to be much more complex over time, over budget than we expected. So I think that the same is going to happen. That's to the point of Ken. It's very difficult to control costs in that type of area, same offshore Brazil. So I think it will take longer. It will be good for the local economy, of course. It's a total game changer for Africa. But it will take longer and cost more money and more time. So meanwhile, I think we see a sort of supply gap growing outside the U.S. So people will be trying to pull LNG outside the U.S.
So what are you investing in overseas? The shale gas is under restrictions. The nuclear industry is dead. There's too much gas. What are you investing in?
Luckily, there is enough to do, because what you see is here in the U.S., you have a much more efficient capital market. And I think what we've seen over the last basically 5 years, maybe longer, because of these unconventional resources, a lot of capital has migrated back to the US. And that is private equity, that is also American oil companies, but also international oil companies. So we see a lot of capital rotating to the US. And that means that for normal investments outside of the US, for instance, in the North Sea or in West Africa, and then you talk about oil and gas production, refineries, good refineries, there is not enough capital. So that's, I think, in the coming years, the real investment opportunity. A lot of demand for capital and not enough supply. So being able to make attractive returns there. Bob, if you want.
Bob, you want to talk a little about in the States and what sort of problems might be created by continuing? You know, we've had the San Onofre plants, but now we have the Vermont Yankee plant being closed down. What sort of transmission issues and power plant? And you've just gone out and purchased some power plants. How does all this fit together in your view of where the grid is going and how it's going to accommodate these different trends?
Bob Mancini.
Well, again, I think the nuclear industry in the United States is, if it's growing, it's going to grow at an extremely slow pace. I do think there will continue to be political pressures to have certain plants shut down. For example, Indian Point, north of New York City, comes up very often. There seems to be a lot of political pressure to shut down that plant. If we do shut down that plant, obviously there's going to need to be another way to substitute for that power generation. And it's certainly, you know, a lot of people think, oh, the panacea is going to be renewables. That's very far-fetched. I think we're just going to have to build more capacity to substitute for these nuclear facilities when they do get shut down.
So it'll
primarily be gas.
Maybe you want to talk a bit about your most recent sort of acquisition in this area.
Sure. There was an announcement this morning that we acquired 5 power generating facilities, gas-fired facilities in California. And we signed to purchase another facility in New Jersey. The thesis around these are a little bit different. In California, there's a couple of things going on. The most significant phenomena is that there has been a introduction of a vast amount of renewable resource, primarily in the form of solar in California. They have one of the highest standards in the country, which is determined on a state-by-state basis, to require that a certain percentage of energy production be in the form of renewables. That's all well and good, but I think the misconception is that that's somehow going to displace the need for thermal production, primarily gas. And that can't be further from the truth, because during the periods when the sun is shining the most, all is well and good. But at those periods of time, when the sun starts to set or when the sun goes down, there's no economical commercial way to store power. And so you're going to need to be able to supplement that power generation with very fast start, flexible gas power generation to be able to basically stabilize the grid and to smooth out the intermittency of the solar resource. So what we bought in California was, in fact, just that. We bought 5 fast start, flexible gas power.
So these are relatively new plants.
Relatively new. This is a technology that, you know, didn't exist, say, 10 years ago. And there'll be more and more of that needed to be installed in places like California and the Southwest in particular. The interesting thing about this acquisition is that it also comes with an expansion site that we expect that we'll be able to, through the use of our Cogentrix platform, to be able to develop an adjacent plant to one of the existing facilities.
I want to come back to something that you mentioned or sort of hinted at a little bit, Ken, which is the role of price. I mean, obviously, as consumers and in the political world, we're all very focused on price, both the currently low price of natural gas, but also the incredibly high price of crude oil. So what role does price, given, you know, how cyclical and how quickly things could change, talk a bit about how you think about price, and maybe one or two of the others want to talk about that too, and what role that plays in your investment decisions.
Ken Hirsch.
In general, I'd say that the classic mistake that people make is to think about investing in energy assets as a proxy for the prices, the underlying movements in the commodity prices. Over the decades, the asset value correlations have very, very little to do with the commodity price. They have a lot more to do with the volumes and the operating costs and the reinvestment opportunities that whatever that project is. If you think about an oil and gas well, all oil and gas wells decline over time. So if you have a long-dated view on oil prices or a long-dated view on natural gas prices that they're going to go up, If you bought an asset today, that asset may be 75% depleted by the time your oil price projection hits. So what good is it? It's much more impactful to get the volumes right and to get whatever the cash flow engine that you're banking on to get that right. If you just want to play prices, you know, have J.P. Morgan with their AA credit write you a 10-year call option on natural gas or oil, and you don't have any decline or any G&A, just hold the position. If you're right, you're right. That does correlate. But unfortunately, in the asset world, what we found is when you go to sell something, if you have a very poor quality asset, it doesn't matter what prices are. Maybe you get a better bid than you had at a $90 oil price than $30. But within reasonable ranges, it really doesn't correlate that well. And that's the mistake that I think a lot of people make, thinking that if you bought low, just throw a dart, this asset, and it'll appreciate. So some of the very, very early mistakes we made when we started NGP was banking on price. And the best deals we did, you know, the first 7 years of our existence, oil and gas prices went down every single year. I thought that was the norm. I thought they were supposed to go down. So, you know,
some people still think that.
Yeah, and all I know is we don't know. And so we tend to focus on the fundamentals of the business and build your portfolio to benefit from an increase in price, but not rely upon an increase in price. Insulate the downside, enjoy the upside, and take care of the volumes.
What about natural gas? Because, you know, it's easy to say, don't worry about the price on oil, because I think we've all come to accept that oil's reached some plateau, that it's going to still fluctuate, but it fluctuate around a higher number. Whereas natural gas, you don't really have that assurance at
right.
all.
Well, what I find interesting, I mean, historically, natural gas being a $3.50 to $4 commodity, it used to be a dollar.
It used to be normal.
So,
yeah.
You know, we talk about low prices, and I think the industry now gets it, that understanding the full cost economics, how much capital has to go in to sustain production, and what's the price clearing that you need to keep that engine going, then you will look at the full cycle, and that number is in the $3.50 to $4 range, depending upon the play, and it can be higher in others. So I think that that's what's really setting the price. And it's a reasonably low price right now, which means probably half of the domestic natural gas plays are uneconomic reinvestment engines today, mm-hmm. and about half are economic. That is unsustainable. So we'll see what happens with economic growth. We'll see what happens with new demand from coal retirements, electricity growth, exports, that sort of thing. The demand equation is spring-loaded right now, and when that happens, I think the price has to go to that marginal clearing level.
So is this the way you think about it if you're thinking about Mozambique?
Marcel Van Pucca.
That's very, very different. But I do agree with Ken. But of course, when you go into an investment, you need a certain price to make it work, be it production, depending on how difficult the reservoir is, you need a certain price. And the same for refining. For refining investment, you need a certain margin. And going in there, we hedge forward. But when you set up the hedge, of course, you need that price. So I think that's very important to understand. Now, if you go to your example, Mozambique, I think we will not be CIP, Carlo International Energy Partners, will not be the one investing in the development of those fields. That's not for us. That's very difficult to... And the reasons are it's very complex, it's very big. That is something for international oil companies. And there is a very high risk, technical risk, financial risk. So that's not typically something for us.
I did a story about the Carlyle Group's investment in the oil refinery in Philadelphia. And a lot of that investment was based on expectation that you'd be able to source a lot of the needs with Bakken oil through rail. Maybe you could talk a bit about that and how your view of that might have changed, because even though it was only a few months ago, not quite a year ago, so much has happened in the relationship of WTI to Brent and Bakken to heavier crudes. Does this look different to you now than before? And if so, how?
Dave Albert.
Well, I would say yes. The world has changed a bit. But at the same time, the refinery has been a great business. And I would say that on the Bakken front, we still anticipate being one of the largest consumers of Bakken crude going forward, despite the narrowing of the delta between WTI and Brent. And the main reason for that is that we're still getting it at a discount, and it still makes sense on a relative basis to Brent. But yes, in the early days of our acquisition of the refinery, times were much better, especially when the WTI Brent spread was much wider, and it was a very attractive point in time. But that doesn't mean, again, that today it doesn't make sense, which is why we're just completing the build out of the rail line into the Philadelphia refinery so that we can take, right now we're taking, I think, somewhere in the order, and Phil can correct me, but I think it's something like 30,000 barrels a day from the Bakken, and we're going to ramp up to about 150 at some point over the next few months.
Well, given how fast things have changed in this business, I was wondering if each of you maybe wants to say something about, you know, what you think is going to be most on our minds and how you could invest now to think about that 5 years from now. When you think about where we were maybe 5-6 years ago, hardly anyone was talking about shale gas, shale oil. We were talking about the nuclear renaissance. Gas hadn't been discovered in Mozambique or any other part of Africa, pretty much. And so, you know, what is it we're going to be talking about 5 or 6 years from now, and how do you prepare for that?
Marcel Van Puca.
I think one of the themes is unconventional in other parts of the world, and for instance, China. China's big consumption, also growing consumption. We have seen big oil companies do early investments. There is a lot of shale gas, we know, but it seems that it's much more difficult to develop. Now, it's early days. But if in those countries like China, if that would develop, that would have a real impact. But difficult to say. I think it's too early to say whether that's really going to take off. I think the whole unconventional, like here in the United States, the big question is internationally, where and how will it play a role for me? And I don't see it that close. It's something we're following very closely. But in the areas where we feel comfortable, we don't see it happening very fast because of political problems.
Ken Hirsch.
I'd say 5 years from now, we will be pounding the table about how the American manufacturing renaissance is well in gear, that the settling down and growing understanding about horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, which has been done in the United States for 50 years, horizontal drilling for about 40 years, how that really is an established practice, and if done right, is safe and effective. There are industrial accidents in the oil and gas business, just like every other industry, but that's the categorizing of it. The industry's made great strides, and I think that as more and more people come to understand that this is one of the great American victories of the world, that we have actually transformed our economy again the way we did when hydrocarbons were found 100 years ago, I think 5 years from now we're going to be talking about ways to capitalize on the then resurgence of American manufacturing.
So are you see some investment opportunities in that American manufacturing revival? And what kind
of the greater Carlyle family absolutely does.
Yeah,
I mean, we're you know, trying to provide the raw materials.
Right.
And we're trying to do it in a very safe and effective way and keep that engine running because these wells decline quickly and you need to be reinvested in, and that needs to be replicated over and over again. And if you do that right, there are high barriers to entry and you can get it done. That being said, doesn't mean it's easy, but we have a very, very established U.S. industry and Canadian industry that has met the challenge every time.
What would you say, Dave?
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, one of the things that's happened over the past, call it 3 years or so, has been the strange dynamic of the relationship between oil prices and natural gas prices. And oil prices divided by gas prices today are somewhere in the neighborhood of, it's like a 30 ratio. When you look at it historically from the 70s on, it's been more in the, you know, 6 to 10 times ratio. So what does that mean long term? First of all, it means today you're paying about 5 times the cost for one unit of energy in the form of oil as you are for that same unit of energy in the form of natural gas. And I guess the question is that sustainable? Well, something has to give. Either you're probably going to see a tightening of that relationship between the two prices, and or you're going to see more electric cars, more cars fueled by compressed natural gas. You're going to see changes in infrastructure that will address that opportunity, because it can't persist long term, at least in my opinion, that you can have fuel that's a fifth of the cost and keep that in perpetuity without seeing fundamental change in the infrastructure around it.
So natural gas fired vehicles?
We're not investing in them, but I'd say that you're going to build more natural gas fired power plants and have more electric cars. there'll be solutions that will be developed in order to take advantage of that cost differential.
Very good. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. Thanks very much. And thank you all.
Thank you for joining us. For more information, go to our website at www.carlisle.com. This has been a Carlisle ValueCast podcast.